Hey, welcome back to Intimate Interactions. Let's get back to discussing the ways we share love and intimacy with our fellow humans. Relationships, kink, polyamory, group sex, it's time to unlearn stigma and live our best lives as our best selves. All thanks to my amazing Patreon supporters. Intimate Interactions has no ads but this one. If you want to keep it that way, you can go to patreon.com/victorsalmon. You get access to exclusive premium content like all of my coping with jealousy stuff. And hey, if that makes you jealous of my patrons, it sounds like it might be time to sign up. Free resources are available at victorsalmon.com/resources, and book recommendations are at intimatepodcast.com/books. Also, my Patreon supporters don't have to listen to this ad. Now, let's talk about the episode. Intimacy can become interrupted in relationships for lots of different reasons. One reason that's pretty hard to deal with is intimate partner abuse. It's heavy, it's often a situation where one party tries to control the narrative, sometimes there's information control going on that can look like repetition of a narrative, or it can look like the assertion of one truth story where there's just like this one version of reality and that is definitely what happened and anything else you hear is a complete lie. Erasure and minimization can happen, and while these things tend to happen along gender lines, that's not always the case. Accordingly, I try and stay as absolutely neutral as possible in these matters, and my focus is typically on two questions. So regardless of what happened, what's going to be different moving forward, and how do we want to get there? These situations are very complicated, and teasing apart what harmful behaviors we choose to call abuse is also hard, although I typically focus on a consistent or systemic approach to reducing someone's self-esteem. That's probably how I would define it. I think it's even harder when in those out-of-balance relationships, it's pretty rare for one person to be completely innocent. No matter how slanted or gendered a situation tends to be, there's often fault on both sides, though not usually equal amounts of fault. Deciding on focus and priority in a multitude of narratives is challenging for communities, and often our gut feelings are influenced by traditional power dynamics and in-group bias. That means we tend to favor people who look and think like we do. In addition to that, we internalize society's view of who us really is, meaning we disproportionately favor dominant cultures. You can think of that as white folks, or maybe straight folks, or men, or cisgendered folks. Typically, there's this dominant culture that when we talk about quote-unquote people, we're talking about that group of people, unless otherwise stated. For example, alternative relationships are literally any kind of relationship that is not heterosexual and monogamous. I've often said, it's not what someone has done so much as what they're doing with it. When there are allegations of some past event, as a third party or as a person in community, it can be very hard for me to just staunchly throw myself in any direction. And I've found in the past many communities fall into the same place of indecision that two survivors can look like apathy. Yet many care about their communities and whether or not folks are actually harmed. If you can't just believe survivors as being very likely honest, at least about their personal narrative or their experience of events, you can ask yourself if the other person is behaving like a traditional abuser would if they had just been called out. It's not that we expect people to be harmless in community, but we do expect them to be improving themselves and making the community safer. Someone caught in the trap of minimizing, denying, or erasing others' experience, someone caught up in informational warfare, blaming the other party, centering themselves as the one truly harmed party. That person, rather than acknowledging that, hey, if I stub my toe, I can both be at fault and be hurting, someone like that doesn't need or deserve your support. Just my two cents. Please note, I'm sick again in this episode, so I might be coughing my way through it. Content warning, if it isn't already clear, we're going to be talking about intimate partner harm, including things like gaslighting. I think the content is useful for healing, but it's my opinion that that should be an informed personal choice. So you do you, take care of yourselves. And now, let's go to the session with Chelsea and hear her perspective on accounting for intimate partner harm. So I will say welcome to all the intimates. I'm going to do that again.
Yeah, that was actually really quick.
I just need like a little bit of space. Welcome, intimates, to another session with Chelsea Blair. We are talking about accountability for relationship and sexual harm today. So, you know, at least not like a really big, deep, heavy topic or anything like that.
No, super light and airy.
Super light. Fluff,
no
really.
Big deal.
Fluff.
Oh, God.
But that's okay. We're going to try and make it as interesting as we can. We'll try and make it as accessible as we can. And ultimately, hopefully you get something useful out of this. Mm-hmm. And we're not just talking for the sake of hearing our own voices. Mm-hmm. Love to hear your feedback. Feel free to engage with us. If you have questions for Chelsea, you can post it all over social media. You can respond to me by email. I'll make sure the questions get there. I could even have Chelsea back. We could answer some of the questions together.
Yeah, that'd be really cool.
Yeah. So it's a hot topic. And please do feel free to interact with us as much as you want. Within reason. I will say within reason because I realize how broad of a category interaction is.
Real. Yeah.
So what does the word accountability mean to you, Chelsea, in the context of harming other people?
Accountability to me means acknowledgement of another person's experience.
Yeah.
And giving that and as much space as you give your own. I think that that's like a basic rundown.
Yeah. I think it's, I mean, for me, I'm mindful of being prescriptive in how much space people choose to give which narrative, because I think personally, sometimes you don't need to give someone else's narrative more space than your own, but publicly you might. So it's like, if I'm in an interaction with someone where I think everything went fine, and just to make this more accessible to a mainstream heterosexual audience, if that person happens to be a woman, and she says, actually, I didn't have a great experience, and like, it was actually a pretty shitty experience for me, then I can sort of be like, oh, okay. Do you want to tell me more about that?
Yeah.
Like, I'm open to you telling me more about that. I'm open to you sending someone to tell me more about that.
Yeah.
I'm open to you writing a thing for me to read. Like, ultimately, I just want to be communicative about what happened.
Yeah.
And I find when you're really open to like, oh, I might have fucked up somehow. Like, that wasn't my experience of that event. I didn't experience it as me fucking up, but that doesn't mean that someone else did not have the experience that I fucked up.
Right.
Yeah. And like, there's no perfect control of that.
Yeah.
Right. Like, there is no interaction you can come out of.
Right.
Where you're 100% sure everyone felt absolutely great about it.
Yeah. And that's entirely true.
Some people hate that uncertainty.
Yes. And I, it's funny because I think that the better we land those moments when somebody's like telling you that they're hurt and that it's because of something that you did, the easier they are to repair. And it seems to me that we haven't gotten to that like causal correlation kind of.
How do you mean?
Like we haven't gotten to a place of like accepting other people's experiences as like making the rest of like what happens next easier and beneficial to everyone.
Right. Like no matter what I were to say in that example, as like a mask presenting person who interacted with someone femme, and then that person was like, holy shit, this was a really either non-consensual or this was like a bad experience or like, this was just an icky experience. It doesn't even need to be clearly cut and dry non-consensual. And in fact, I think in my interactions, I would like to hope that's less likely because I have a whole framework called the Voices Consent Framework to talk about all of the different kinds of best practices around consent and all of the different ways that we increase our risk or decrease our risk of someone leaving that experience with the notion that what happened was non-consensual.
Right.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, but it's still like the people might have interactions that don't land as 100% consensual.
Yes. And there are lots of reasons why they may not speak up about that right in the moment.
Of course. Yeah.
So that piece about like having an interaction with someone, coming away from it thinking it was okay, and then hearing later that actually it wasn't for the other party,
right,
can be really challenging because that kind of like flies in the face of your like worldview of that
of binary
that
consent.
Little bit of your life, and like the values that you've placed on that experience,
yeah,
yeah, and I like. and not like not it's funny because like there's baby steps towards like being an accountable person, and one of the baby steps is just simply like not minimizing.
Yeah. Like you don't have to have the one and only narrative.
Yeah. Like you don't have to have the one and only narrative, and also like not like forcing that narrative that you have on the other person and therefore like discrediting theirs.
Right.
Or attempting to convince them of otherwise.
And I think part of the nuance there is recognizing the difference between your intention
mm-hmm.
and the impact of your actions.
Yes. And we like, there was a thing that people were saying for a while. I bet people are still saying it. That goes something like intent isn't magic. And I feel so conflicted about that statement because yes, it isn't magic. It doesn't magically make the things that we do like land the way that we intend them to. But it also like, I think it still matters in terms yeah. of how we're looking at like the whole encounter from both people's perspectives.
Totally. I think intention's important mm-hmm. and holding space for intention is in a sense holding space for the narrative mm-hmm. of the initiator of the engagement.
Right. But I also think that like when some, like the times that I have come to like tell people when they've done things that have hurt me, and if they come out with like, well, that's not what I meant, and like start rambling in right. dissent, like not in dissent, but like in going on about what their intentions were, to me, that doesn't really land as supportive.
Totally.
It can land as like an attempt to overwrite what it was that happened because they intended things to be different.
It's also perspective switching.
Yes.
If someone's focusing on, here's what it was like from my perspective, for someone else to immediately flip to, well, but here's what it was like from my mm-hmm. perspective.
Yeah. And I think that that can be done well and it can be done poorly. Like, I think that there are ways to say like, oh, wow. Like that's completely different from like the right. way that I looked at it. And like, can right. you please tell me more? Because right. this was like,
I feel like this is just a big miscommunication.
There's like a disparity in like how we each experience this thing, and I want to understand yours better.
Totally.
I think that there's like being accountable involves like centering the other person's experience.
Yeah, at least for a time, if yeah. not. Yeah.
If not like in those normal, air quotes normal. heterosexual instances where like oftentimes it's a woman who has been violated by a man type, there's a power differential there already in terms of social power. That means that like it doesn't take men a lot of like narrative exertion to like completely steamroll the other person.
Right.
Like it just takes a little bit because the imbalance is so real.
Yeah. People are going to listen to you if you're a man in a way people won't listen to a woman.
Yes. And so in order to kind of offset that, and this is something that like seems to be basically impossible in like normal society. In order to offset that, we have to really focus on centering the experiences of people who have been harmed, typically women, because they're already at such a disadvantage in terms of being heard and understood that we have to like work more to kind of offset that like pull to go the other way.
And when I've talked with survivors in the past, what's interesting is how organizations will get a hold of a story or a complaint and run with it in a direction that they want to run with it
mm-hmm.
rather than honoring what the survivor actually feels, which might be
yes.
this person hurt me and yes. I want to feel like on good terms with them again in some way, or at the very least, I want to feel safe and yes. able to hold space in community, even if we don't talk again, which is
yeah.
fine for some folks. And then you'll have organizations that'll be like, this person's a menace, we should run them out of town, like that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been times when the survivor's like, I never asked for any of that.
Right.
Like, this isn't something I'm interested in.
Yeah. And it's like, it takes all of the players in a situation like that to really know where they're coming from about what they think people want and need and what their actions are in terms of like what they think is right or wrong.
Right.
And to be able to like differentiate those things out, which is a tall order. Let's be real.
Yeah. It's super hard. These are hard situations.
Yeah. The work that I'm doing with survivors of relationship abuse with Franklin Vo, we're very much attempting to center the survivors' experiences in a way that reinstates their voices into a like very long-standing narrative about relationships that he's been in with these women. Mm-hmm. He's written a lot of stuff online for a lot of years about his relationships, and often the women's experiences have been erased, and they would like an opportunity to speak on that because they were there too. Mm-hmm. And they had experiences that were completely, in some cases, different from the ones that he was portraying.
Right.
And I think it's really important that they get an opportunity to speak on that.
I mean, it sounds reasonable.
Yeah, it sounds reasonable. You wouldn't believe how much skepticism and scrutiny and criticism we're fielding on, like, the broader internet over that piece. Like, I wish... personally, that the kinds of scrutiny and criticism that we're experiencing in conjunction with these women's stories, I wish that that kind of scrutiny and criticism were turned on Franklin's story.
Right, that it would at least be even.
Yeah, but it's not.
Right, there's going to be an inherent belief of brands that mm-hmm. we value and of reputations that we value.
Mm-hmm. and that is... endlessly frustrating in the work that we're trying to do here.
Not to mention, as we were talking about in a previous podcast, the notion of trauma being cumulative, also probably frustrating in the context of being socialized a woman and having mm-hmm. your perspective not valued or treated mm-hmm. with the same level of skepticism as masked
tale as old as time.
That's so appropriate that you would pick Beauty and the Beast for that.
Yeah, right?
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
So the word accountability has to do with being able and willing to hear an additional perspective to your own, at least one.
I really think that that's a primary tenet.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of the first step.
Yeah.
Like, if you aren't able to hold space for other perspectives on the way your social interactions have gone, mm-hmm. it's going to be a problem. Mm-hmm. Like, when people talk about objective reality, because... so many voices love to fall back on this idea of objective reality. It's like, cool, what's the objective reality of an awkward social situation?
Right.
Like, what's the objective reality of what your body language is communicating? Mm-hmm. Like, to what extent do you not understand linguistics mm-hmm. of, like, what the multitudes within language mm-hmm. that don't lend themselves easily to the notion of an objective reality? And to what extent have you... thought about studying body language mm-hmm. and the multitudes that gestures can hold that we may be communicating unconsciously. Mm-hmm. Like, there are so many variables that it's very hard to describe a social interaction as objective.
Yes.
And to talk about the objective nature or truth of a social interaction, in my opinion, is very hard to do without ignoring and missing the social interaction altogether.
Right.
That's just my perspective.
Like, total tiny little tangent off the side of this. Have you ever talked to a person who experiences non-consensus reality?
Non-consensus reality? No, I have not. Are you talking about synesthesia?
I'm talking about schizophrenia.
Oh, okay.
Like, someone who experiences things that aren't...
what other people experience.
Yeah, aren't what the majority of everyone else is experiencing. And I'm using really inclusive language here because I don't want to say things like delusion or like crazy or whatever.
Really stigmatizing words.
Yeah. I have had conversations with folks who experience that sort of stuff, and they have described to me the having to basically go through what is happening in front of you and decide what's real and what's not.
Mm.
And that real air quotes, is like, takes up a lot of bandwidth and can like easily, like the cart can easily kind of tip off the cliff into a place where, there are harmful behaviors.
Definitely.
But anyway,
as a side note, I want to give a shout out to Senua's Sacrifice, Hellblade, the video game that takes place from the perspective of a femme presenting Pict, which is to say like an Iron Age Scottish mm-hmm. warrior who has schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire game is sort of an allegory for their coping with like the destruction of their village and the death of a lot of people that they care about dearly.
Wow.
And
amazing.
The amount of effort that went into not making it stigmatizing and getting you in the seat of like trying to understand what it's like to have a toxic internal monologue and literally having amazingly voice acted content whispered into your ears of like different ears, different times, different emotions being portrayed.
Yeah.
And to have that relate to in-game content, like to literally have the voices in your head laughing, like you just can't see stuff that's right in front of you, or like,
wow,
like it's intense as fuck. It's a great game.
Yeah. That sounds amazing. And like,
it got a lot of awards.
Eye opening.
Like,
yeah.
Like I'm surprised it wasn't called out.
Yeah.
Like, try to make a game that fundamentally centers someone who's schizophrenic as your main character. Like, right. I would expect that to get called out like crazy.
Yeah. And it's like schizophrenia, though, like, that's a very medicalized, like, stigmatized language to use to describe people who experience non-consensus reality, whereas, like, other cultures that, like, I haven't experienced because white lady in Canada.
sure.
Would look at someone that, like that as a visionary or a shaman or
sure,
like seer.
Like some kind of non-consensus reality where you just see things other people don't see, and that can either be interpreted as seeing things that aren't there.
Right.
Or can be interpreted as seeing something different.
Yeah, like seeing something different and seeing something useful.
Yeah.
In and that difference.
Even if we're looking at things from like a very strictly medicalized or scientific method-based approach, to what extent is that person perceptualizing their cognitions, things they're aware of that are just different things they may be perceptualizing in a very vivid or different sort of way, but they may still be seeing things that are legitimately there, whether that's simply the sum of their subconscious or the sum of their insecurities. They're still manifesting things from like a reasoned, this came through a human brain and means something tangible and important. So like, what is this reality they're constructing and how does it stitch into the reality of the rest of us in a very nonlinear way?
Yeah.
Or not even in a very nonlinear way, but in a different way.
Right. And I will tie this back to gaslighting.
Oh. Okay.
Because
I'm along for that ride.
In essence, as a like survivor of gaslighting myself, the physiological experience of having someone in essence direct the conversation from a place where you're speaking about what's happening for you and like and hurt that you're experiencing to a place of like feeling like that's all in your head and you're crazy.
Right.
Isn't that like that to me is the impact of gaslighting. And like schizophrenics experience gaslighting all the time, like from themselves and from medical professionals and from like everyone else.
Right.
In essence,
like their reality is said, we say that their reality isn't real, that those things aren't really happening.
Yep. And that they're crazy.
Right.
And that that's their problem as opposed to like something bigger. So I think in like, in a like basic heterosexual gender situation where oftentimes gaslighting is perpetrated by men who don't understand what a lady is just going on about. And why she's so upset.
Right.
And are like denying that we have experiences of harm.
Right.
Which is the basis of the work that I'm doing with the survivor advocacy team as well. Is like we're unpacking intimate partner emotional violence.
Right.
And kind of trying to shine a light on like how that can play out in relationships that involve more than two people.
Right. Which is complicated.
Yes. Extremely complicated and like complicated. And,
avoid triangulation, folks.
Yeah.
Run away.
Right. Or name it.
Yeah. Or name it.
Name it and try to like get to a place where everyone can acknowledge that like different things are happening for different people.
Right.
And that's okay.
And
like,
we should explain what triangulation is as well.
Yeah, we totally should.
Do you want me to do that?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, so let's say that you have two friends. I'm trying to think of really like unisex names. Let's say Alex and... Is Bobby unisex now? I think it's pretty unisex. Sure. Okay, cool. Alex and Bobby. And Alex makes a comment to you about Bobby and something that Bobby does that kind of rubs Alex the wrong way and like lands really shitty for Alex. And you're just like, oh, if these two people would just talk to each other, this would get so resolved so quickly. So being the triangulated person you are, since in this example, let's say you're eight, you go to Bobby and you're like, hey, Alex was talking about this thing and like... Is it possible for you to just, like, not do that thing when Alex is around? It doesn't seem like a big deal to me. And Bobby's like, well, yeah, okay, I guess I can stop doing that thing. But, like, also, like, it really sucks that Alex didn't come and talk to me about this themselves. So Bobby's now holding all this resentment to Alex that's unexpressed to Alex.
Because there wasn't a conversation that happened between two people based on the interaction that the two people initially were having.
Right.
Right.
So there's a third person brought in as an intermediary running messages back and forth between these two people. That causes all kinds of problems because of distortions of messages. And also, if Alex miscommunicated, maybe Alex said, I don't really like it when Bobby, like, plays with his or with their paper around me. And... it sort of came back to Bobby as like, you know, and you like pick up that like foolscap paper and you blow into the end of it and it makes that really irritating sound. Now this is like a third person maybe interpreting saying, well, Alex doesn't like when Bobby plays with their paper, but I really don't like when Bobby like makes noise that's disruptive with their paper. And one thing
so gets that's different.
A totally different
game
interaction.
Of telephone.
Yeah. And even if it's not necessarily a game of telephone exactly where your words end with purple monkey dishwasher.
Right.
Even just that little tiny narrowing, that little bit of interpretation can be really significant. So all of a sudden, Bobby's resentful towards Alex and Bobby stops blowing into their paper, but keeps like ruffling with it. And Alex is just as upset as Alex has ever been. Bobby has now experienced a little bit of shaming because it wasn't something that could happen directly, maybe feels a bit of interruption or damage to that relationship.
Yeah.
And the initial complaint was never fixed.
Right.
And now the third person that's been brought in is possibly upset that the community is not functioning the way it used to function.
Yeah.
Why didn't the repair work?
Yes.
And of course, all the fault immediately gets placed on Bobby for having this disruptive behavior that wasn't socially approved of, whether it's right or wrong. I mean, who cares if you're leafing through your paper? But some people do.
Yeah.
But because it's socially disruptive, it all becomes Bobby's fault. And more to the point, people are upset that Bobby was already told once.
Right.
But what was Bobby told?
Right.
So there's like all of these other conflating things that literally could have all been avoided if Alex and Bobby were able to sit and have that conversation. That's problematic when you start applying it to alternative sex communities and especially sexual assault, because those people can't always sit down.
Yeah.
So it starts becoming this problem of triangulation that's really hard to solve.
Yes.
So like I approach this using impact statements and in that way, I'm able to take like Alex's direct words on paper and be like, I don't really know what this means.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I can't interpret this for you, but like, hopefully you can interpret this sort of.
Yeah.
And I think it's very important to not center quote unquote bad people. And I think it's important to note that like accountability isn't just for the bad people. Like it's for all people.
It's for all people for sure. Yeah. That's absolutely true.
So that's sort of triangulation. It, it tends to come up in non-monogamous relationships where you're in a V configuration, which means, let's say, Alex is dating Bobby and help me out with a C name.
Chris.
Wonderful. So perfect. So Alex is dating Bobby and Chris. Bobby and Chris are not dating each other. Bobby is dating Alex. Chris is dating Alex. Are Bobby and Chris still in a relationship? They're not dating each other. They're not intimately interested in each other, but they're both dating the same person. So what we usually describe that as is a metamorship between Bobby and Chris, where both of them are dating the same person. So triangulation happens when Chris is like, it kind of bugs me when like Bobby says this stuff on social media that's like vague booking about me. Could you tell Alex, could you tell Bobby to stop doing that?
Right.
And Alex is like, hey, Bobby, Chris was mentioning to me that, you know, they didn't really like when you were blogging or when you were kind of vague booking on social media, could you just try not to mention them like try to make that metamorship work like a little better. K thinks bye.
Yeah.
And it's very much this triangulate-y, I'm going to take a message, interpret it, and deliver it, as opposed to, wow, that sounds pretty intense, Chris and Bobby. The two of you should probably go for coffee and work that out.
Yeah. And like redirecting the conversation back to the two people that are having the conflict in the first place.
Yeah. To be like, it is not a solution for me to try and intervene.
Yeah.
If you need me to sit down as a mediator, I can help facilitate that conversation.
Yeah.
But like, you two are the ones that need to have that conversation for repair.
Yeah. And I think that it is in like, it's instances of like broader harm involving more people that then more people get involved.
Yeah.
Like the place that I'm in now, in terms of this activist work, is that like I'm advocating for a group of women and attempting to support their voices being heard.
And that's it, really. Just having their voices
and, like,
be heard.
Making space for them. Like advocating for space to be made for them.
But like literally that's the extent of it right now. It's just making space for other accounts, other experiences, other ways of parsing the same events.
And like, I didn't realize this for a really long time, but apparently it's like kind of a bit of a superpower to like accept that someone else's reality may be completely different from yours.
Yeah, it kind of upsets me that that is the case, but I agree with you.
Yeah.
I was also told that that was something of a superpower when I'm like, yeah, so this person had a negative interaction with me. Like, it's not my place to be like, fuck you, that didn't happen. It's like, well, we were both there for those events and they're telling me that this is how it landed for them. They're the expert of themselves. They're the expert of their experiences.
Yeah.
Just like they can't tell me what my intention was in that situation.
Yeah.
I can't tell them what the impact of my words or my actions was on them.
Yeah, entirely.
We are all the experts of our own experiences, regardless of gender.
Yeah, and that is lost in the fray of patriarchy and white supremacy.
Definitely.
And class.
Even what you were saying about typical cis men being like, I don't know what these women are on about, is the same narrative you hear from white folks being like, I don't know what these angry, stereotypical POCs are on about. It's like, maybe if someone's consistently pissed enough for it to be a stereotype, there might be something worth looking into there. Like, it's possible those people are angry for a reason.
Right. And something that actually came up in like the accountability work that I'm doing, and something that we like ended up discussing quite a bit when it did come up, was this concept of like repetition. And how like basically like this simple act of saying, I don't understand, can you explain it more? And personally, like as someone who has had to like repeat herself over and over again in terms of like what life is like for me at times, it starts to like, the more repetition and like the more it doesn't sink in and you don't find that point of connection, like when you're saying like, it's like this, like this cup is purple, please believe me, and they're like, I don't get you, can you tell me again, but like with like a different way of saying it, and then you like say it in a different way and they're like, yeah, I still don't understand, like the ongoing disconnection can like have the same residual effects for on the psyche as like a gaslighting experience, where you just like feel like the more times you say it, the crazier you feel,
because
you're not
like,
being understood, so like and then all of the self-doubt of like a normal woman type experience starts to sink in, and like, oh God, maybe I am crazy. Like, I've said this 5, 6, 7 different ways and they're still not getting what I'm talking about. Maybe I've made this all up in my head.
Yeah, like that kind of doubt, especially if you have a history of gaslighting, that kind of doubt's so damaging.
Yeah.
My mom used to gaslight the shit out of me. Like flat out tell me that things she said 2 hours earlier that she'd never said.
Yeah, that's awful. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it definitely kind of fucks with your underpinning of reality.
Yeah,
and
it definitely
like
does.
For a long time, I thought that's what my dissociation was, that it was just that everything in reality seemed equally plausible.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's just because I don't have a firm grip on reality and I'm okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then having my therapist be like, no, that's pretty clinical, like classic dissociation. That's mm-hmm. really normal for depression. Like, it's not a special other thing. It's just part of depression for a lot of people anyway. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, so it's hopelessness and dissociation. That's a good response to hopelessness.
Mm-hmm.
If all of the things you're trying to do don't work, freezing and dissociating are a very normal, healthy go-to.
Yeah. And I think that oftentimes, like in relationships, what we're looking for, as I mentioned at the front end of all of this, is connection.
Yeah.
And solidarity and the sometimes willful disconnect is where harm can perpetuate itself. Cause yeah, like the, like trying on someone else's experience and really like, and trying to connect it to your own as well. Like right. There are probably lots of like, you're like, we're of like different backgrounds and different like gender socializations and things like that.
Totally.
But there are like ways that you can speak about your experience and then I can go like, huh, yeah, that kind of sounds like a thing that I've been through and like do that in my head and be able to kind of like, and be able to empathize, with what you may be experiencing.
Totally. Sometimes as a mask person, it can be hard sometimes when you, mm-hmm. when you talk about these like highly gendered dynamics until the second where I'm like, oh no, that sounds exactly like the way I interact with white people sometimes. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense that she has to deal with this all the time.
Yeah. And I think that like, it's like, it's quick and easy for me to listen to people of color talk about the kinds of marginalization that they've experienced and accept it as fact. Like you told me that happened and I believe you.
Yeah.
Because of that little bit of subjugation I've experienced.
Yeah. I totally resonate with what you're saying.
Yeah. Which means that like, yeah, it's like intersectionality.
Yeah. Intersectionality.
Like, yeah. Different kinds of power in distributed in different ways.
Yep. And just understanding that it's really, even though it's convenient, it's really imprecise to talk about the ways that we get fucked over by society one at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it would be easy for me to say, oh, I was assigned male at birth and I was socialized as a boy and you were assigned however you were assigned at birth mm-hmm. and socialized the way you were socialized, which I'm assuming is as a girl and assigned female at birth. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah.
Cool. And like I make all of those assumptions based on pronouns,
right?
Which is pretty crazy, and to a little, to a small extent, femme gender presentation as well.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, all that aside, it's really easy to talk about that as one dynamic that has one set of consequences,
mm-hmm.
and it's imprecise in the same way that it would be like so imprecise to talk about you as a white person and me as a non-white person.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yes, those dynamics do exist, mm-hmm. but none of them are independent of any of the other ones.
Right. Entirely.
And that's complicated. And people don't like complication like that. Like,
no, we really want to be able to like simply math out.
Yeah.
How to be in the world. And it's just not, it's not simple not and there's easy. No math and it's gray as fuck. And like,
yeah,
it's messy. Like relationships are messy.
Yep.
Oh my God. So messy.
And I think like even just being compassionate and patient with yourself.
Yes.
Just showing yourself the love of like, this shit is fucking hard.
Yeah. And like, and also like in efforts to behave in accountable ways, like if you fall on your face at your first attempt, like get up and be like, I need a mulligan on that. Like, wow, I can't believe I just said that. Can I try that again, please?
And that's okay.
And like, provided you have like some trust built with like the folks that you're engaging with, but maybe even if you don't and they just happen to be particularly open to a change in direction, it can go really well because like you're trying, like you're again owning your shit, owning the fact that you fell on your face on your first attempt and like want to try again.
Yeah, what it comes back to is, like, what's going to be different this time?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I would always say. Whenever mm-hmm. someone asks me to try again at something, whether it's a relationship, whether it's a conversation, mm-hmm. the number one question on my mind is, what's going to be different this time?
Mm-hmm.
Not from an accusatory place, but, like, what work have you done?
Mm-hmm.
What's changed? Why do you want to have this conversation again? And why do you expect it to go differently than it went the first time?
Yeah, I talk often in my, like, super close relationships about opportunities to practice. Because like I can get better at being accountable, but I mean, if I've had a particularly stressful day or like maybe like didn't have like all of my protein that I need or whatever, didn't get a great sleep the night before, then I might like behave in a way that wouldn't be like ideal for like what I expect of myself. And that can like ebb and flow depending on like a lot of other circumstances. And that like context, yo, it's so important.
Context is so important.
So important.
So in my voices framework of consent, the C stands for is that like, what is the context of the consent? Mm-hmm. Like, is the consent in context? And that speaks to all the reasons that people feel coerced to say yes, mm-hmm. or like all the reasons why people choose to say yes when they could just say anything else. Mm-hmm. But all of the work and exhaustive feelings that come with, if I say no, then, mm-hmm. Or not trusting that if a person says no, that mm-hmm. that other person will respect that no.
Yeah.
There's like all of that baggage, and there needs to be space in the consent conversation for those things. Mm-hmm. But so long as we keep clinging to this really flawed idea of consent as a binary, where yes. there's a line beyond which you go to jail and you're a bad person,
yep.
but literally everything gray and everything on this side of that line, mm-hmm. you're fine. You got consent.
Yeah. And like, and then we get into like frameworks of harm reduction,
right?
And applying those to accountability processes and just in like day-to-day relational
day-to-day
dynamics.
Love it.
Like there are ways to reduce harm. Like harm will happen.
Yeah.
Like that is a given. We like literally mm-hmm. can't not experience harm unless we just like put ourselves in a bubble and like never leave our houses. But then even we won't be able to maybe earn money or get food, which could be harmful anyway. Yeah.
I have some introverts that would contest you on that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Thank God for Fedora.
bring me food.
Yeah. And like, yeah, I think that like there is like we all grew up in the world in like a family dynamic that probably for one reason or another was kind of fucked up. So there are things that are going to hurt us that maybe like are based on some of those experiences, but also mm-hmm. like, we're just going to behave in ways also like not only receive behavior, but like execute behavior, because of some other shit that has nothing to do with the person standing in front of us.
Yeah.
And
what's that?
Like finding space to be compassionate to that.
Mm.
Instead of being like, what the fuck are you doing? Say like, hey, are you okay?
there's a quote that's like, no one is introduced to violence as mm-hmm. a perpetrator.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's such a powerful quote.
Yeah.
Because it holds space for...
That's very significant.
The multitudes.
Yeah.
There's just so much to everything behind the moment where mm-hmm. someone is violent.
Right.
Whether that's abusive, whether that's emotionally abusive, or mm-hmm. whether that's literally physically violent.
Yeah.
There's even, I was looking into restorative justice, and there's a community justice initiatives in Kitchener.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a survivor support group for... only for people who are survivors of sexual assault who have gone on to commit sexual assault on others.
Wow, that's so amazing. I'm so glad that exists.
It exists somewhere.
That's so great.
And they specifically focus on like family sexual assault, like yeah. incest type cases, mm-hmm. which is like harrowing.
Yes, harrowing is a word I would use, yes.
Speaking as someone who is, even just as someone on the outside looking in, who yeah. has dated someone who's been a survivor of incest, it's, mm-hmm. oof. Yeah.
Wow.
It's just from what I can see on the outside, not to in any way imply it's comprehensible to me, but mm-hmm. what a fucking tour de force
yeah.
of self-awareness,
yeah.
of going to counseling, of getting up every day and just like fucking body slamming yourself into yeah. the world and all of the stress and anxiety and all of the, you know,
yeah.
side effects of trauma and what it looks like to be repeatedly traumatized at a young age.
Yeah. I like in my pursuit of social work, I have had to take into consideration the things that will, maybe be like hills I would die on if I tried to climb them.
Right.
yeah. And one of those hills is working with men who have perpetrated, childhood sexual abuse.
Oof. That's a lot.
Yeah. That to me is Everest.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether I would be able to, like, I don't, like, I mean, to, like, go capitalist for a minute. I don't know if there's enough money in the world.
Yeah.
For me to, like, walk into that particular burning room.
Yeah, that's a lot. There are professionals that do.
Yeah, In fact, I like commend their bravery and like thank goodness for them, because there's like opportunities for rehabilitation for people that are, fact of the matter, like just very hurt.
Yeah.
And acting from a place of hurt.
Or have a paraphilic disorder that's harmful to others.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there is a distinction to be made here between paraphilic disorders and paraphilia.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who enjoys getting, for lack of a better word, experiencing a lot of pain and is sexually aroused by that, mm-hmm. that's a paraphilia.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who likes inflicting that pain and getting aroused by that, mm-hmm. if it's done consensually, that's a paraphilia.
Mm-hmm.
But the second it starts veering into non-consensual territory, now it's a paraphilic disorder.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where were we? Do we want to ask another question?
Yeah. I mean, I think we still have time for one. We have like 9 minutes to five. How are you doing on time?
I'm good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. I'm also good on time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we talked a little bit about accountability. We talked a little tiny bit about support teams and how challenging it is to just be willing to appreciate the nuances of a situation of multiple perspectives,
mm-hmm.
of just like leaving behind that notion that social interactions need an objective reality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yeah, the objective reality might be something very not useful, because you might talk about all the gestures a person made and you might talk about all the words that came out of a person's mouth
mm-hmm.
in this very objective way. And none of that invalidates that people were traumatized or very harmed by those words.
Right.
And none of that really says you shouldn't be accountable or responsible in some ways
mm-hmm.
to the people you intimately interacted with who were harmed in their interactions mm-hmm. with you. Like, really, there is some community responsibility there to just honor the people that were willing to share their bodies or their minds or their lives with you.
Yeah. I would agree with that for sure.
Yeah. But I think that's a much more convincing way, personally, to approach the idea of maybe departing a bit from this one narrative idea of objective reality.
Yeah, objectivity is a fallacy.
Yeah.
Like,
for human beings, it absolutely
is. We pretty much have that on good authority now.
Yeah, I think so.
And attempts to seek an objective truth can erase folks' experiences.
Absolutely.
Which is harmful.
Yeah, even on standardized testing,
mm-hmm.
a lot of those tests are written to certain lexicons that yep. certain ethnic groups of people will perform better in, or certain yes. genders will perform better in.
Yes.
That's the problem with language, is language can be very different for different groups of people.
Yeah. It's, oh God, I was in a political science class that was focused on feminist theory and discussing English language and how it was in essence like developed by men, and how that meant that there are things that happen, like to me as a woman, things that I experience in the world that are actually unspeakable because there aren't words. Like, the language was developed with an absence of my well-being in mind.
Is there a way for you to conceptualize some of those things with made-up words?
Yeah. I find a lot of like, I describe like imagery at times, and I use metaphor, storytelling. Like, those, I find metaphor to be really helpful.
Could you give an example of something that might be more accessible for someone who maybe isn't quite at the same level of understanding?
So there are like a million different ways that like I've been trained to act as a feminine person.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't describe all of them. But I can use the metaphor of like a computer.
Right.
And say that there's like I was installed with an operating system, and there are like a bunch of directive kind of impulses that sure. that the operating system executes.
Sure.
And I can't write the code.
Right.
But they're all in there.
Right.
Brains
are neuroplastic, though.
Yes.
Like, over time, it is a thing you can maybe eventually overcome.
Yeah, and I'm very lucky that, like, that I don't experience a lot of, like, I don't experience a lot of dysphoria in terms of how I was socialized to be a feminine person and, like, what my body is like. I took on that operating system pretty readily and happily and, like, haven't really felt like it was in any way wrong for me.
Right. You're really happy with femme gender presentation.
Like, I'm very privileged in that way, that I don't experience discomfort with the way that my body is and what I've been socialized to do with that.
I mean, it's kind of hard to ask a person to find words for a thing they're saying they can't find words for. So,
yeah,
like, I acknowledge the question's a very hard question for you to answer.
Yeah, I was actually thinking, like, to bring it back to gaslighting again, I was thinking about how, I've used the metaphor of an Etch-a-Sketch, where it's like, okay, I drew a picture in the Etch-a-Sketch, and then, like, someone shakes it, and the picture disappears because they shook it.
Right.
I'm describing an experience, or I'm, like, trying to talk about, like, what's happening for me, and then, if I were to, like, use a whiteboard to, like, draw that picture out, like, someone takes an eraser and, like, literally erases it and says, like, no, it's like this, and grabs the marker out of my hand and starts drawing.
Right.
Things like that.
So, like, a lot of correction.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of, almost infantilization.
Mm-hmm.
There's, like, taking up a power position mm-hmm. of redefining the world.
Mm-hmm. And the language is authoritative.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, wow, like, that's interesting because I see things completely differently. And let me talk about what I think. Or is it okay if I talk about what I think right now?
Yeah.
And, like, making space for there to be, like, for my reality to stand on its own.
Right. And some of that might be English, but I think more of that would be the culture behind it.
Sure. Yeah.
Not to correct what you were saying.
Yeah, No. I totally.
I see the irony in this.
Yeah, and I think, like, I mean, it happens in racialized ways as well.
Sure.
There are so many layers to oppressions that, like, Indigenous people and other people of color have experienced.
Yeah.
That I am, like, just never going to entirely be able to comprehend because the words are going to fail me. And they're going to fail them.
Well, even if we talk about cultures of words,
mm-hmm.
right? Not even the language itself, but cultures.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when people talk about rope in the Vancouver community, mm-hmm. they often use the word bondage. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about white people specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that's a very racialized word.
Yes.
Like, to use the word bondage means something very different than to use the word restriction or restraint. Because if we talk about rope restraint, mm-hmm. cool. That mm-hmm. doesn't have an intense charge.
Mm-hmm.
When people start talking about rope bondage, like, all of a sudden, you're hitting some of those words that are related to threatening topics
mm-hmm.
that someone coming into that space, hearing a group of white people talk about bondage, might just be like, you know what? My body's telling me this space is a no for me. I'm going to leave.
Yeah.
And then they leave. And then our community in a city that's 50% white at most
mm-hmm.
ends up being 90 to 95% white.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that sort of thing that can sort of paint a space as insensitive to racializing language.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure the exact same things or very similar things probably happen when mm-hmm. it comes to gender interactions in workspaces or in alternative communities.
Yeah. A lot of the things that women know how to do with, like, on a cellular level are not noticed or valued or are considered evidence of weakness.
So you're talking about things like anticipating someone else's needs and, like, doing,
or just being emotional, like, the, like, just being openly displaying an emotional position.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I were to start crying right now,
mm-hmm.
it would make it, like, and not for at any, like, of any faults of your own. And actually, I'm probably sure you'd probably be decent at this. But, like, if I started crying right now, it'd probably be harder to take what I was saying seriously.
I mean, I want to believe that's not true, but I'm sure you're probably right.
Yeah.
Keep in mind, though, I'm a unique person in that I do a lot of BDSM.
Right.
And, like, one of the big things cis men are accused of in BDSM is stopping violent scenes when their bottom starts to cry.
Because
it's hard for them to process that as a consensual experience if mm-hmm. someone's crying. But I'm like, whether or not someone's crying has very little to do with whether or not it's consensual.
Mm-hmm.
So whether it's my relationship to mental health, like, whatever that happens to mm-hmm. be, I am really comfortable continuing a scene while someone's crying. So yeah. long as we've had the conversation,
right.
is it okay to continue this while you're crying?
Yeah.
And if that person's like, I'm good and gives me a thumbs up, I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Carrying on. So typically if someone's crying, I do my best to ignore whether or not they're crying.
Right.
And focus instead on the content of the rest of their body language and the right. content of what they're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a crier.
Cool.
Like I use it as an example often because like, if I'm experiencing like emotions outside of like a pretty like baseline 5 level, I'm probably crying.
That's totally fair.
And like if I'm like sad or happy or mad or like any of the things, like if I'm experiencing it,
extreme
like
extreme emotion triggers tears.
Yeah, totally. Cool. And it like it's really hard to convince people that I'm like outraged when I'm bawling my eyes out. Because a lot of people associate that with sadness or like...
I'm so done with people associating everything with sadness. Depression yeah. for me is not sadness. Yeah. It is hopelessness. There's a difference.
Yes, there's a big difference.
It's a big fucking difference.
And for me, I also experienced some depression and it's very much a somatic feeling. It's like moving through mud as opposed to like just moving through air.
Do you want to know what the clinical term for that is?
Sure.
It is psychomotor retardation. I thought you'd get a kick out of that. I thought you'd get a kick out of that.
Perfect.
But that is what quote unquote professionals, the ones with authority, that is the wording that they use.
Yeah.
But it's like when your whole body slows down and yeah. even when you're trying to move at a regular speed, it feels like you're moving through molasses. Mm-hmm. Like you have that, like, it is just harder to make your body do things at a certain speed.
Yeah. And it like takes a lot more effort to actually like pick up and do something. Like if it's time to get out of bed, it's just like, I'm going to sit there and scroll Facebook for an extra 40 minutes or whatever.
Whoever invented infinite scroll is just like my fucking nemesis.
Yeah. Real.
Millennial problems. Infinite scroll.
Yeah.
What a marketing genius, but what a horrible human.
Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Anyways. So the window of tolerance comes up. When you're mentioning that, I think about the notion of like hypoarousal and hyperarousal. And when I'm using the word arousal, I'm talking about our mental activation.
Mm-hmm.
So like the state that you're in. Depression's often characterized as what's called hypoarousal, mm-hmm. like where you're not as activated. And I think when you get to the point of feeling like you're moving through sludge,
mm-hmm.
you're at such a low level of activation that like literally chemically like making your body do the things is an effort.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big so effort.
What I find interesting about that is I'm really experimenting, and this may be a bad idea, but I'm experimenting with myself when I'm feeling anxious, leaning into depression just a little because they're sort of opposites, but not opposites.
Right.
But there's a little piece of it there where literally if when you're moving too quickly, you can remember what that sludge feeling feels like.
Right.
You can sometimes slow down that movement and be like, oh, I feel a little more balanced, even if I feel heavy on both sides of that balance.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's not a solution, but it's a tool I sometimes use.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Similarly, like fast paced music in my head when I'm feeling slow or just using that fast-paced movement or like frenzy sort of feeling to be like, oh, I just have to get out the door right now. And then finding myself outside my apartment, I'm just going to go to my car.
Yeah.
And when I'm in my car, I'm going to drive to the place. Yeah. When I get to the place, I'm going to go in and do the thing.
Step by step.
Yeah.
One step at a time.
But using a sense of urgency or almost using anxiety as a touchstone a little bit to be like, I just need to get outside. Like I have to get out of my house right now.
Right.
Without having like, again, not leaning in too hard, not having a full blown panic attack, but just like, oh no, I actually have to do the thing. This is urgent. I'm 5 minutes late. This is important. I need to go.
Yeah.
Like kind of giving myself that, like I need to go.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
What's stopping me getting out the door right now?
Try that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And see how it goes.
But it's just a tool and use it with caution. This is not necessarily therapist recommended or maybe it is. I don't know. I'm not a therapist, but like things to think about.
Yeah. It sounds like regulation.
Yeah.
Sounds like regulating a little on like the left or right.
It's kind of using
depending on where you're leaning anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's kind of using experience with mental illness to regulate your mental state.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
But it is an act of regulation. Yeah. Yeah. Of trying to get in that window of tolerance, like below hyperarousal and above hypoarousal.
Yeah.
And like the more amazingly awesome your brain is, the wider that window is, mm-hmm. where you have like normal, tolerant mm-hmm. experience of the world, and the more probably traumatized or like devastated you are or depressed you are mm-hmm. As a person in general in your life, probably the narrower that window is, which means it doesn't take much outside of that window to just like drive you totally in that direction.
Yeah, that makes sense. So use with caution.
Use with caution, but also learn coping strategies. Yeah. Like learn the various tools that will help you stay in that window of tolerance. Mm-hmm. Learn the ways of interrupting anxiety when it's just small, not mm-hmm. a panic attack. And like learn the behaviors you have that do the opposite.
And this ties back into the accountability stuff, because like feelings of like hyper or hypo arousal can occur when you're being confronted with something that you may not want to hear about some way that you've impacted someone else.
Definitely.
And like remembering to like slow down and pay attention to what your body's doing and then regulate.
And it's okay in to the ask, face of that. It's okay to ask for it at a different time.
Yeah.
Like it's okay if someone's saying you really harmed me to just be like, I hear you. And knowing that I participated in any way in that kind of thing mm-hmm. is doing a thing in my body right now. And I'm like panicking mm-hmm. and I just need like 20 minutes, mm-hmm. maybe even the night to like mm-hmm. try and figure out why I'm like losing my shit right mm-hmm. now. But just as a communication, currently I'm kind of losing my shit and yeah. I need to go.
Yeah.
I'm open to having this conversation at some other point.
And schedule that shit.
Yeah.
And then be accountable to that.
Yes.
Because yeah, coming around in timely fashion is yes. a big deal.
And I get
and doing what you say you're going to do
is also a big deal for building trust.
Deal.
And yeah. ultimately trust is the social capital with which we do repair.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's a soundbite right there.
Yeah, it totally is. Absolutely.
Well, I think that is us for our podcast for today.
Awesome.
Thank you so much for all the time that you spent putting into this, all this work that you're doing in accountability.
Thank you.
It's valuable, it's useful, and I look forward to reading your work on it.
Thanks.
And also, if you look forward, audience, to reading Chelsea's work, I will try and post links. Chelsea, do you have links yet?
Yes, I do have links.
Wonderful.
I'm going to give them to you, and then you can post them on the things. I have links for the Medium Survivor Support account, where we've written pretty monthly updates about the work that we've been doing, and also to a PayPal pool on which we are accepting donations, because we have a lot of people that are doing a lot of free labor on this thing.
And do those people happen to be femme-presenting people by any chance?
Most of them, yes, but not all of them.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. So we are accepting donations from the community so as to compensate folks for their time and expertise and continue slogging along with this thing.
Thank you for all the work that you're doing, and I will post those things. And if you like this episode, tell other folks.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time. Bye.
Bye.
So how did you like it, Intimates? Leave your comments on facebook.com/intimateinteractions or directly on patreon.com/victorsalmon. Both communities are easy to find from intimatepodcast.com. So what are you waiting for? Go join the free Intimates community and start connecting with others. I'll see you on there. Disclaimer. I apologize if I said something that hit a nerve or played off a hateful idea or stereotype. I'm open to being called in. Chances are, in 6 months, I'll look back aghast and see something problematic I've since grown from. I'm certainly not perfect, but I am trying to be mindful of the voices I lift up and the perspectives I encourage. You can email feedback to podcast@victorsalmon.com. Thanks for your kindness. Attribution. The tracks I use are published under the Creative Commons Attribution License. The intro track was Lost Souls by Portrayal, and the outro track was Resurrection by Uncle Milk. Land acknowledgement. I apologize first for any pronunciations I might butcher. I wanted to acknowledge that I recorded this podcast on the unceded traditional Coast Salish territories of the Musqueam, Kwantlen, Stizuminus, Stolo, Tsawwassen, and Tsleil-Waututh nations. Shout out to the Sekwepemc Nation, on whose land I got my degree. Considering the Kamloops Indian Residential School closed only in 1996 when I was 10, I have found nothing but unending patience and kindness in the Tkemlupste Sekwepemc folks with whom I've interacted. Let's never forget genocide in the hope we don't make the same dehumanizing, cruel mistakes again. Thank you.